through Jason's folly, he found himself allied with death and, worse, the returned pretender. The only saving grace was that the pretender was far less capable than the first time he'd appeared in Ardeen. He possessed a flickering spark, war-sensed, of the Maker's flame, but nothing else. The greater part of him was missing, locked away, no doubt, in the Maker's hall. A chariot-sized cray rushed War, its open mouth screaming some high-pitched roar. War snatched one outstretched pincer, spun the massive creature about, and flipped it 30 feet through the air. Its descent was broken by one of the blade-like glass splinters along the line death defended. The Maker's Hall, War continued his thought, where Jason had so badly wanted to go, where they still needed to go if the Kray invasion was to be pushed back. If they found entry, War and everyone else in Ardeen would be saved, and the pretender would again become the Maker. War called up Jason's spark of consciousness so he could interrogate it about Carter Strange. But Jason wasn't having it. The mortal, who'd sought so long to strip himself of fear by losing himself in War, had finally succeeded. The act of resignation was perilously close to suicide, which sickened the incarnation. He let Jason fall back into darkness. He spared a glance over his shoulder. Carter Strange and his Kephlum stooges were still there, but instead of continuing their efforts to enter the hall, they'd been forced to fight for their lives against the thickening press of Kray that had slipped past him and death. Perhaps he hadn't been as diligent as he could have been in keeping the Kray away from the pretender. War laughed when he saw an even larger concentration of Kray racing forward across the glass. These weren't horse-sized or chariot-sized. They were large as houses. He sensed each would offer him a challenge worthy of any he'd survived during the Age of Myth. "Fight! Fight!" he roared to his warriors, expelling a dozen or more each second for all the good it seemed to do. Half-died, impaled on pincers, or wrapped in dissolving webbing within moments of their birth. Yet, it was glorious. They died in the heat of strife, blood raging and exultant. For indeed, today was as good a day as any to die. Sometimes wars are lost.
Chapter 36 Fervor Catherine Manners. Following her tumultuous departure from Mageddon, the tiny vessel leveled out as it arrowed west. Kate stopped cursing after her heart rate resumed normal speed. Not long after that, she fell asleep, exhaustion pulling her down into gauzy nothingness. She must have slept most of the night through because it was dark outside the next time she opened her eyes. Red streaks of approaching dawn glowed through the portholes, which reminded her of submersible viewports. Not that she'd ever been in a submersible. She bent closer. The glass was cold on her cheek. Below, the ground raced past, in a smear of darkness streaked with gray blurs. Above the horizon, the sky grew lighter. The interior of the craft was too small to stand, but Kate could sit up without grazing her head on the metallic ceiling. She rubbed her neck and the sleep out of her eyes. "Hello," she said. "Raoul." Worry struck her that she'd never see him again. Maybe without her awake, his spirit had slipped away for good. What if... Raoul's hazy shape materialized next to her. If he hadn't been immaterial, he wouldn't have fit. His body glimmered like an old nightlight, enough to light up the interior of their vessel. "Good morning, sleepy," he greeted her. She was intensely glad to see him. She decided not to share her momentary worry. "Hi yourself."
"You know, this thing is damn cool," said Raoul, gesturing around him.
Kate was confused at Raoul's apparent surprise. "You should know. It was yours. She stopped short before reminding the man she'd taken the cipher from his corpse.
"Ciphers are plentiful," Raoul said, "if you know where to look. But the method for finding exactly the kind you want has eluded even rock scientists, and they've been looking into it for a while. I didn't know for certain how this would manifest."
She snorted.
"Well, it seems to be the right one for the occasion."
"I kept it back in case I ever needed to make a quick getaway. You are lucky. I like to be prepared."
Kate doubted he'd been prepared for death.
"Damn it, stop that,"
she silently remonstrated. "Too late." She wiped a bit of moisture from her eyes. Raoul inquired,
"Are you all right?"
"I've been thinking," said Kate.
"Never a good sign," Raoul replied.
That particular exchange was one of their comfortable traditions. She smiled to hear Raoul's usual rejoinder.
"He was the same old Raoul," she said. "If this Maker's Hall is everything myth says, we should try to get in, too."
"After we stop war," said Raoul.
"Yes, after we stop war," agreed Kate, "but right after that we go in, hopefully on Carter's arm.
Get him to show us the controls for magic resurrection or whatever it's called here, and put your spirit through the process. We can get you back."
Raoul's eyebrows rose in surprise, and he stroked his non-existent chin.
"Sounds great," he agreed. "But it's not the primary goal."
"But it's a goal," she insisted.
"Promise," he added, "that Jason comes first. Don't be a hero on my account."
She grimaced. The idea of saving Raoul had already pushed aside her concern over Jason fucking Cole.
"Why not do both?" she said. "If you save me, but lose the world in the bargain, I'll only live as long as you and everyone else, which will likely be only until the Betrayer, or Jason, or whatever that puta madre ends up calling himself, gets what he wants. He intends to bring the power of the Maker to Earth. That won't work out well. Probably not even for him, ultimately."
Raoul had a point. The man could be single-minded, and sometimes wrong, but usually his advice was sound. This was one of those times. She couldn't fault his logic. "All right, I promise," she said. She meant it, even though it felt a little like giving up on her friend. Raoul's specter grinned. Rather than meet his eye, she leaned to peer out the front viewport. They'd reached a height over Ardeen that, although probably not as high as jets on Earth flew, was still several miles over the plain. "Would you look at that storm?" she said. Thunderheads piled together, one towering tier crowding the next, glittering with flashes passing between them. They marched in from what seemed like the edge of the world. The storm hadn't yet covered the glass desert over which she realized they must have been flying since before she woke. But the cloud system's rapid pace suggested it would manage that feat within a few hours. And after that, go on to cover a much bigger swath of the landscape. For some reason, the idea made her uneasy. The craft's nose dipped precipitously. They began to descend. Kate mentally traced an imaginary line of their course through the viewport. They were too high for her to make out much, but the area they aimed for seemed to be just in advance of the storm's leading edge.
Was that where Carter was?
Had to be, unless their flying cipher was malfunctioning. "We're coming down," Kate said. "We're headed right into the teeth of that storm, so..." So that meant nothing to someone who had no physical form. Raoul sat with her, his face also taking in the raging clouds. His head cocked. He said,
"Catherine, that storm isn't natural. It is of the strange. Where it touches, Ardeen is being eroded. Perhaps consumed." What the hell was Raoul talking about?
Kate narrowed her eyes in concentration. The sun rose in the east. directly ahead of them. She shaded her eyes with one hand. The light streamed over the lip of the world, sending illuminating shafts into the flank of the storm. The storm didn't care, but then Kate saw what Raoul was talking about. The clouds of water vapor concealed something awful.
"Cray," whispered the part of her heart that had taken in Ardine's context.
Or maybe it was desire. Either way, if Cray, in this incalculable number, were streaming across Ardine, it suggested one reasonable and apocalyptic interpretation. The world was ending. She caught the hint of a Cray taller than a skyscraper lumbering through the clouds after all the others.
Oh, no. It was horrible, but it was wondrous, too, like nothing she'd ever imagined before.
"This can't be happening," Raoul whispered. "Those things are going to eat Ardine to the ground. If they do, they could find a way to Earth. The big one is something that shouldn't exist, even here."
"Use me," a fervent voice demanded.
This time, there was no uncertainty regarding its source. Desire still encircled her finger. The incarnation wanted free rein once more. The last time she'd let desire call the shots, Kate barely got her mind back. Letting desire loose again was something she'd unconsciously decided to avoid. The last time desire had possessed her, the personality in the ring seemed reluctant to let go. It desired Kate. Next time, it might not ever let her go. But the vision through the window was essentially a rendition of hell. If Raoul was right, a hell that wouldn't be satisfied with Ardine, especially not now that Ardine was freshly connected to Earth. Could she sacrifice her mind, her will, her life to help save everyone else?
There was no guarantee that Desire's aid would do anything to stop the disaster she saw unfolding below her.
She dragged her attention away from the Godzilla plus-sized monster. From the vantage of their approach angle, they'd plunged into the storm. They were close enough that a desperate fight on the glass's surface resolved. A small army of human-sized figures faced off against a far vaster army of spider-lobster monsters that came with the storm. Among the defenders, she sensed War, Death, and Commerce, her ring's siblings. Of the Maker, however, she wasn't sure, but there was something. They all fought upon the image of a magnificent fortress reflected in the glass, which shone all the brighter in the glass for the storm's gathering gloom. Its breathtaking grandeur put the walls of Mageddon to shame. Even though she knew it was only a likeness, the image was like a promise of the Maker's Hall returned.
It wasn't manifest yet, but it would be if she arrived in time. Damn it, she was going to do it, wasn't she?
Trust in the consciousness that inhabited the band on her finger. A personality that valued things only as much as it wanted them. And it wanted everything. Maybe even to save the world. Before she could give herself an out, she acted.
"Save Ardine.
Help the Maker," Kate instructed her ring. Nothing happened. Something restrained the incarnation bottled in the ring. Part of her wasn't even really surprised. That part of her that always feared to believe in the impossible, in case she was disappointed, to play it safe, to be cynical.
"Kate," wondered Raoul.
She looked at him. Her cynicism was what had kept them as friends and nothing more for years. The fear of disappointment had done that.
And now it was keeping desire from manifesting. Naming the thing meant she could master it or try to.
So she told herself that it was okay to believe, okay to want the impossible. It's worth taking risks with your heart. Then desire was smiling. It was an expression so dazzling that the tiny craft confining her dissolved in its radiance. The consciousness of Catherine Manners and her otherworldly haunt
faded away in the same blast. Desire knew the exultant shriek of wind in her hair as she plunged spread-eagle towards the hall's entrance. She was a falling star, serving as a new sun in her brilliance. All beneath her paused to glance at her speeding descent. In their hearts, desire kindled, and her power redoubled. Even the Kray, in their alien way, wanted her. Probably for food, but hunger was also aspiration, and it strengthened her. The sensation of being wanted was as intoxicating as it had ever been. She would never give it up again, Desire decided. In fact, in the warmth of that appropriation and her fast dwindling view from on high, she decided that she would take charge of Ardeen. The Maker had had his time. His time was done. 4 incarnations were required to form the key to the hall's lock. 3 waited below, as did the one who had once been the Maker. Desire made 4. She plunged down like a fiery fist, punching the glass desert with the energy of a meteorite strike. Every erg of that power was channeled into the creation of a keyhole. The key created by the presence of the 4 turned. The Maker's Hall opened for the first time since the Age of Myth concluded. Chapter 37 Exaltation, the Maker. A plunging star burned a descending arc across the sky, aimed right for me. Desire had arrived. The moment Desire's aura snapped into existence as a blazing streak overhead, the grim brooding of death, the brash challenge of war, and even the incoherent mumbling of commerce were easy to put out of my mind. I could no more ignore Desire than I could shrug off my finger in an outlet. Only the hint of the Maker's cognizance that I retained saved me. Otherwise, I'd have dropped everything in favor of standing rapt, like the humans, the Kephlum, war, death, and even, if just for a moment, the Kray around us. Of all the rings that might have answered my call, I hadn't expected Desire. I'd left it behind on Earth, but somehow it had followed me here, and it was embodied. Only an Earth native could wear a ring of incarnation and claim its power. I couldn't imagine who it might be, unless it was that woman Catherine Manners. Had she somehow managed to bridge the divide and bring the ring with her? But I sensed no hint of the underlying personality, whether it was Kate or someone else entirely. Only Desire burned, dropping like a bomb. I pushed Shiraza away from Ground Zero with a violent shove. The Kephlum went skidding at least a dozen feet on the glass, leaving me directly beneath my prodigal incarnation. I expected to be obliterated in the blast when she hit. In a way, I suppose I was. Maybe she hit. Maybe she didn't actually physically touch the hard surface at all. It was irrelevant. Her gathering power, as well as her presence linked with the other 3 incarnations, ignited an inferno of incandescent energy. The radiance bloomed like a nuclear sunrise. When that light refracted through the glass, it was bent as if through a prism. Color raced out across the glass desert. At the intersection, a door opened. The valves parted, swinging inevitably and unstoppably outward. An even brighter illumination shone out from the interior. I passed within. It was like a hand clapping in mine in friendship. Laughter from afar, the odor of a pig roasting on spits, lights in the distance and singing and more. A million sensations and emotions poured through me. It was both too much and not enough. Too much because my brain threatened to burst with the unending torrent of knowledge. Not enough
because I knew there was an organizing principle within the hall that would make sense of it all. I knew it. I just had to find it before my brain fried. And just like that, I had the answer. I opened myself and looked out across all Ardeen, as if viewing it from an infinite height and depth simultaneously. I was in the Maker's Hall. All things were mine to know. It was merely the way things were. Where I turned my gaze, I saw a bee sipping nectar from one of thousands of daisies growing in a meadow, an eel angling through the waters of Oceanus, hungry for its next meal, a magnificently feathered dragon coming in for a landing on a roost set aside in the citadel of the harrowing, and a thousand other events, both consequential and not. If I focused on one thing, my view and knowledge of it expanded like a flower blooming with ever deeper fractal petal layers, revealing more and more about what I examined until no secrets remained. Secrets so fundamental that words could not bound or describe them. But a meta-language existed. Using it, the Maker had named things beyond naming. The battle raging around me decelerated, as time itself seemed to grind to a halt for all except me. Knowledge of things, great and small, lapped across my consciousness like an infinite ocean of cognizance. With a start, I realized that once again, I was the Maker. When I described darkness, midnight rained. When I described a mockingbird, the sweetest birdsong that ever was warbled forth. When I described my mind whole and without distortion, so it was. So I remembered all of it, even those things I'd hidden from myself in shame. What I had done before and what I had allowed to be done. To save Earth in that first flush of Ardeen's creation, I sealed myself and my friends away beyond time and existence in the real world to keep Earth safe. There had been no choice. They understood that, didn't they? Was it too much to ask? I simply made their choice for them, a choice all of them would have made if they'd been given a chance. Jason complained the most bitterly and vociferously. No one else said a word. Everyone else said they understood, that I'd done the right thing. Who could argue with the logic that the good of many outweigh the good of the few? It was the only choice, they said. But I knew, behind their words, they felt betrayed, to one extent or another, too. Because I hadn't consulted, I hadn't given anyone any options. Jason called me a selfish bastard and worse, to my face and behind my back. Later, selfish is what he called me, when in his guise of war, he shoved his flaming weapon through my heart. My guilty heart, because Jason had been right. I was a selfish bastard. Here in this place where all things were known, I couldn't evade the truth, or the memory that fell on me like a dead tree, pinning me with regret. I was a liar. When I'd first taken on the mantle of the Maker, I could have returned all my friends back home, translated them into fresh new bodies. Sure, there would have been questions back on Earth regarding the corpses that resembled them found in the computer lab, but they could have at least had a chance to live normal lives. But to do what I needed to do, to cauterize Ardeen's intrusion into the strange, I would have had to stay behind, alone. And I hadn't wanted to be alone, had I? No. Misery loves company. I'd imprisoned my friends along with myself when I'd cut off the land of the curse from its initial connection with Earth. I'd trapped them with me when I could have let them go free, because I'm a fucking coward. The Maker's Hall provided a godlike perspective to truly see myself as they had seen me. What I saw wasn't pleasant. Because even though I numbered among the most powerful beings in Ardeen, save for the Kray broodmother that thudded forward and Lotan who burned under the rocky crust, I had imagined myself a purely moral and unselfish being. The truth was that I had been afraid. In my fear, I'd let logic justify my actions rather than human feeling of true compassion for my friends. I'd thought to conquer my fear through endless plans and contingencies. How much evil would have been avoided if I'd thought of my friends first and acted out of human feeling? Though more by inaction and direct decision, I'd kidnapped my friends and kept them here with me. Jason's betrayal sprang directly from what I'd done. And what about my other friends I'd trapped here? Had they hated me as fiercely as Jason? Alice, Sanders, and Mel? I couldn't ask them because they were long dead. Actually, something was odd. For all my transcendence, I couldn't find any histories embedded in the world for Alice and Sanders. Jason and Kate, on the other hand, were close as was Mel's great-to-the-nth granddaughter, Ellendine. Well, war, desire, and death were nearby anyway. The human consciousnesses of the hosts were suppressed, though Ellendine seemed to be fighting submergence with a modicum of success. Wait! Alarm blazed like an exploding star as I realized war and desire had rushed into the hall after me. Were they? No, they were contained, though it had been a close call. If they'd gotten in ahead of me, one of them would have been raised in my place and taken the Maker's cognizance for themselves. The danger of that happening had come and gone. Now they chased down endless corridors of colored light, refracting through an endless maze of prisms. They were caught until I released them. The time slowdown was mere illusion, an artifact of my own vastly increased cognizance. In fact, time was slipping by, and the planet of war known as the Kray Broodmother advanced. I had to act soon. Once more, I had to decide. I focused on the entity that walked in the eye of the storm. She was the same monstrous planet of war that had gazed across the starting grid during our very first trial of the enhanced VR gear. She hadn't forgotten. She'd bided her time, waiting out the years and centuries, sending her Kray through the cracks and imperfections of Ardeen's walls. Despite how I'd tried to slow the time so precipitously that no contact could occur. No plan survives contact with the enemy, and with the Maker's death, my death at Jason's hand, the Broodmother found more and more weaknesses in Ardeen's defenses. Exploits, mostly in the form of a desperate and reckless Jason Cole, though there'd been others. I traced every crack, every seam, and every intrusion from the moment Ardeen was first dumped into the dark energy network to now. I held the visualized construct in my mind as a single, hyperdimensional object. From that perspective, the entire land of the curse was like a fine crystal vase shot through with fractures. One more solid knock, and it would shatter. And the Broodmother was a giant fucking hammer. Repairing the damage would not be easy, given the timeline. If I couldn't eject the Broodmother and her armada within the next few minutes, I never would. Within the manifold space of the Maker's Hall, I had many hands and many mouths to manipulate and name the elements of Ardeen. Healing the breach in my world would require all of that and more. I needed help from the incarnations. Unfortunately, only three were manifest. With all seven, it would have been a tough task, but doable. With only war, death, and desire, it would be a gamble. And sacrifices would have to be made. "Some maker you are," muttered one of my mouths. not even willing to admit that you're getting ready to do it again. Sacrifice others to save yourself. Making a logical plan because you're afraid to do the human thing. I paused. Was it true? Yes, there was a chance that by tapping the full efforts of war, death, and desire, the underlying human minds and bodies would perish. Jason's mind might be burned out of war, leaving the original entity behind, or maybe not even that much would remain. Maybe only the ring would be left behind. I wouldn't feel that bad if that happened, because Jason, despite that he'd arguably been driven to it, still needed to be put down. Catherine Manners and Queen Ellen Dean faced the same risks, another me reminded myself. You'd feel bad about killing them, right? Though if you do nothing, it'll be out of your hands. They're already starting to fade away with the incarnations riding them so hard. They're giving it their all, and the longer you sit in here dicking around, rationalizing the easy path, the more likely it is they'll never come back. So really, Carter, what do you want? I want to save Ardeen and Earth with it. Sacrificing a few people to save everyone else shouldn't even be a choice. It was an agonizing decision. But yes, sacrifices had to be made. The good of the many outweighed. Don't give me that bullshit, you self-centered fuck. Jason was right. You can fix this by yourself. You're just afraid. Of course I was afraid. It would kill me if I tried it. I'd die. Oh. The admission shocked me. I hadn't even considered the one other option on the table. Because you're a fucking coward. Fear was the antithesis of war. Or at least I'd always assumed. But fear was also the antithesis of humanity, of doing the right thing for me. In a way, I'd been seeing what I hated most in myself when I saw Jason. Jason was kind of like my dark reflection. He was just as afraid as me. We were not so different. Shame burned through me. All the many instances that multiplied throughout the hall. Yet again, I'd considered sacrificing my friends in order to assure success. A tactical impulse designed to hide from myself what I was actually doing. Not this time, I promised myself. As I decided to save my friends, even Jason, uncertainty tingled through every micron of my being. Was I brave enough to throw myself in front of the bus to save Jason, Ellen Dean, and Kate? Doubt was a stone in my heart. Trepidation dragged like an anchor. I feared what I would decide. Even though I was the Maker, I was also Carter. Self-sacrifice really wasn't my thing. But damn it, for once in my life, I wanted to do the right thing. That wasn't too much to ask of myself. And the fact was, technically, I could leave everyone else out of the process. Instead, I could meld myself, my will, and my existence into the cracks. That would work. And it would certainly be my end. The Maker would once more be absent his creation. Without him, the rings would recede to their earlier minimum functions. War would go back to being merely the betrayer. Ellen Dean would have the ring of peace, not of death, and desire wouldn't swallow up Catherine Manners whole. But I was the Maker. In naming my weaknesses and failings, I laid them bare. Seeing them exposed for the mean and pathetic things they were, I cast out doubt and fear. Warmth, like sunlight, stroked my face. Light filled my eyes so that I had to blink back tears. I could do this. How many people ever get the opportunity to correct their biggest mistakes? If the Maker, If I force someone into a role they don't want and thus stifle their free will, who's to blame if they act out? Me, that's who. I stretched out my many hands to touch each and every crack and tear in Ardeen's fabric. I cried out with all my mouths with words that seared like a welder's flame. I did what had to be done without doubt or fear. As before, all things were mine to know as I turned my multifaceted gaze across, under, and through Ardeen. A child lost in the meadows above Ardeen was shown the way home. The broken leg of an explorer lying alone in a Kephlam ruin was mended. A warrior on the glass desert, succumbing to a Kray wound, was healed. Minor miracles spread across the land of the curse, so that for a time it was the land of the blessing. But this was only me stretching my powers, limbering up. To save the world would require more. So more I gave, feeling myself fall into smaller and smaller pieces, with godlike cognizance falling away like all the stones in a bridge tumbling into the dark water below at once was both terrifying and exhilarating. The layers of fractal blooms closed one by one, obscuring their meanings from me, robbing me of the Maker's knowledge of secrets both deep as the true significance of the dark energy network and mundane as the color of a newborn baby's eyes in Mandariel. Everything was stripped from me, and I poured it all into the fracture Jason had created, welding it shut with my own continuity of being. In the end, it was easier than I ever expected to lay down the heaviest burden of all, my ego. And so, Ardeen was made whole again.
Chapter 38 Recognition Elendine, Queen of Hazurium. Lantern in hand, Elendine walked the path of the dead under the light of the seven moons. Their cold radiance splintered on the raised road that wound for miles through the queendom. Crypts honeycombed the rampart beneath their feet. In those metal-clad and lightless cavities, the dead of Hazurium were interred, from the lowliest beggars to royalty. According to tales told over campfires, the souls of the dead sometimes ventured up from the night vault to walk the path of the dead, looking for their loved ones to bid them goodbye. "You won't find her, Your Highness," murmured Navarre, who followed a few paces after the Queen. Behind the first protector, what remained of Elendine's forces were arrayed in a line stretching back along the otherworldly route. "I know," the Queen replied, her voice almost too soft to hear. After a minute of silence, Navarre said, "Forgive me for saying this, but are you all right?" "You mean why am I not biting your head off for mentioning my dead sister Flora?" Navarre coughed. "Yes, my queen." Elendine nodded thoughtfully. It was a good question. Being death meant that I had to come to terms with a few things. Imagining you giving up your free will, even to an incarnation, is a difficult task. Elendine chuckled. That was the least of what was required of me. They walked without words for several minutes. The queen thought she caught a glimpse of two spectral figures gliding along the path in the moonlight, but she wasn't sure. A heartbeat later, and they were gone. Elendine rubbed at her eyes, then sighed. To summon death, to become an incarnation, I had to stop running from the sorrow and accept that everyone dies, everyone, even Flora. Burying my fear of grief under a royal tantrum or running away across Ardeen to challenge some other threat wasn't going to work. I had to stamp out the hope that I could avoid that heartache if I just kept ahead of it. And so, you walked
as the incarnation of death. Had I not seen it myself, I wouldn't have believed it. As it is, I almost wonder if it wasn't all a dream.
It was no dream. Death came, and I was her.
Will you do so again?
Ellendine cocked her head.
Was it possible?
I hope not. I almost lost myself, drowned in the incarnation's dominion. The Maker saved me from that.
When Carter Strange did whatever he did inside the Maker's hall, death blew like a leaf in a gale, lost. And I'm glad. The ring is back to what it always was. It's mostly powerless once more.
I'm sorry that your plan to use the ring to return your sister has failed.
Seeing Flora alive again was always a fool's hope. The words out of her own mouth sounded strange, not like something she would have ever admitted. But they were true. Flora was gone, and there was nothing she could do about it.
You have my deepest condolences, Your Majesty.
Sorrow trembled on her cheeks like warm rain. It wasn't the heart-rending grief she'd always feared to face. Though she felt as if a hollow in her chest filled with cold water, it was bearable. Fresh tears smeared the star and lantern light. She mopped at the moisture with her sleeve. When was the last time she'd cried? She remembered Brandolin comforting her when she was 10 years old. Her mother had just informed Ellendine that her father, the royal consort, had been lost in a border skirmish with Mandariel. Brandolin had been stern and stiff-jawed as she relayed the news. But Ellendine was shattered. She wept for 5 days. She'd been useless. She hadn't taken in any of the instructions provided by her tutors. She could barely mount the will to eat. When her grief finally broke, Ellendine had vowed never to let sadness pull her down again. As she'd grown older, she learned that fury was the answer to many things, but especially whenever anguish threatened. In anger's narrow certainty, there was no room for heartache. Her mother had seemed to approve.
"Where do you think Brandolin really is?" Ellendine asked.
"If I knew, I'd tell you, Your Majesty," replied the First Protector, her voice not quite hiding a faint defensive tone. "Of course, I didn't mean to imply otherwise. I just miss her." Ellendine had been furious with Brandolin for fleeing Flora's death, flying off on another one of her important quests, rather than face the truth. Yes, Flora had been killed, and her mother hadn't been able to bear the pain. But Ellendine was her daughter, too. Brandolin had run away, looking for some mystical mechanism, abandoning the queendom just when everyone needed her most. When Ellendine needed her most. Just as Ellendine had in turn run away, looking for her mother. Just as Ellendine, not even the Queen Dowager, had literally abandoned her rule to a regent after she lost the ring. She'd had her reasons, but she was no better. She was just like Brandolin. The truth rolled up over Ellendine like a torch flaring to full brightness or a slowly mounting orchestra reaching its crescendo. She saw everything in herself that she despised in her mother. They were the same. The same. "Have I been too severe or unfair when it comes to Brandolin?" she asked Navarre.
"I'm sure I couldn't say, my queen."
They walked. Flora never appeared. Instead of her sister, Ellendine thought of her mother for many miles under the moons and stars. A glow on the horizon was revealed as a massive walled structure as they drew even closer. Ellendine pointed. "There it is. Citadel Hazurium. We've got a bitch regent to unseat and a queendom to take back."
Chapter 39 Evaluation. Jason Cole, the betrayer. War was gone. Jason was merely himself, the betrayer. Again. The ring was robbed of almost all its power, hardly more than a trinket, because Carter was dead again. The man's return had empowered the ring, but his second fatality stripped the power of incarnation from it once more. Was it ironic or comedic? He wasn't laughing. Instead, he smoked, drawing on the stem of an exquisite water pipe one of the five princes had shipped down from Mandariel a decade earlier. Which one of those backbiting weasels had sent the gift? He didn't know or care. Jason sucked in a long breath of smooth smoke, then let the smoke curl out of his lungs. His private chamber was already hazed. None of his homunculi had permission to enter on fear of death. This place was for him alone. So he sat, burned tobacco, and remembered. What is fucking ironic, he thought, was that Carter had been the one who started everything by killing his friends and trapping their minds, betraying them. But somehow, Jason was the one saddled with the title of betrayer. Sure, he and the others had survived in the recursion, but tell that to their parents and friends on Earth. If they had learned the truth, Carter would have gotten the chair. Jason wondered if he would have done the same as Carter. Would he have sacrificed everyone, including himself, to save Earth? He didn't know, because he'd panicked. He hadn't understood the full picture. But if he'd known, would he have done what Carter had the first time around? And again, when he'd entered the Maker's Hall and pushed back the Cray, sacrificing himself in the process. No, never in a thousand years would he do that. Carter, he yelled to no one, I fucking hate you. No, you hate yourself for being such a coward. He always had. The truth was too uncomfortable to entertain. His mind skipped away to better times when he hadn't been alone. Jason missed his friends. He even missed Carter, at least as the man he'd been before everything soured. Jason hadn't really had any friends since coming to Ardeen, except himself, and he was sick and tired of himself. The question he was actually avoiding came to him again. What the hell was he going to do now? The peace that the smoke sometimes imparted took hold, and he half-closed his eyes. Things hadn't been a total disaster after all. Hadn't he reconnected Ardeen to Earth? Yes, he had. Maybe not in a way that would allow him to return home in the full glory of the incarnation of war, no. But a bridge had been forged. Now he had time to figure out how to cross it, even if in a lesser guise. This time, he wouldn't have to ask the Cray for help. Too much horror and fear lay down that path. War would have been up to the task of dealing with them, if only... Stop it, Jason told himself, and inhaled another breath of blue smoke. He'd tried to let it all go and hand over everything to war. He'd failed. Nothing was going to change that fact. So he could either give up, hand over the reins to one of his lieutenants, and walk away from Mageddon, or he could try again. Chapter 40 Celebration Catherine Manners. The bar light shone amber through Kate's martini. Its bittersweet bite was familiar. It soothed her. More than anything else, the unique flavor reassured her that she was home and safe. "Then what happened?" asked Liza Banks, leaning avidly across the table. Liza was making short work of her second ruby-colored cocktail. Paldridge nursed a glass of something amber-colored. They sat in a bar south of Seattle called Shindig, a little far from Kate's regular city stomping grounds, but not nearly so pretentious nor crowded as most places that served specialty drinks to the north. And the martinis were the best. Kate said. The next thing I knew, I was standing in the middle of the glass desert. The Kray were gone, all of them, even the Ikor. It was just me, Queen Ellendine, and that bastard Jason Cole. We blinked at each other like idiots. And Carter, the Maker's Hall? Asked Paldridge. Kate shook her head. Gone. Not even a reflection. Liza shook her head. That must have been something. Everything that happened after Desire went nuclear is hazy, like I dreamed it. Though I do remember we got into the hall's front door. I wanted in as badly as Desire did, for Raoul's sake. But Carter was ahead of us. He got in front of us, locked us out from accessing the higher functions. It was all so, she waved her hands, hard to describe. Metaphysical. Carter said he would take care of the breach, that it was his cost to bear this time, that he was finally going to be honest about his emotions and face his fear. Then he melted away. Liza wrinkled her nose. Melted? Yeah, melted, and released whatever Maker's essence he'd collected back into the hall and into the land of the curse. I think he sacrificed himself to save Ardeen, and somehow to save me, Ellendine, and that Dick Jason, too. He saved us from drowning in the incarnations. Paldridge coughed and set his drink down with a clink. So he's dead? I think so. Liza sighed. Sad. He would have been such an asset for us. Kate snorted. Sad because a good man died. Of course. Sorry I interrupted, said Liza. That's okay. Liza swirled her drink. What did you mean by drowning in the incarnations? I don't understand. When Carter did his thing, Desire let go of me. She didn't want to. She just couldn't hold me anymore. She faded away. Same was true of the Queen and Death and Jason and War. Ellendine wasn't as excited as I'd have expected, but Jason was furious. He wanted to lose himself in war, in all that game world made real insanity. But without Carter around to energize the rings, things went back to how they were before. The rings faded to what they had been. The incarnations still don't walk Ardeen, which seems like a blessing. The whole Age of Myth thing was better as a story than as reality, if Desire was anything to go by. Paldridge shook his head, tried another mouthful of his whiskey, then held it up to examine the way the light shone through it. Kate sipped her martini. The glow from the alcohol in her stomach made it all a little easier to relate. The ring of Desire yet encircled her right index finger. It no longer possessed any particular ability, especially here on Earth. It was mostly an ordinary ring, despite its striking appearance. Ordinary, except for its ability to translate. Having it with her on Earth seemed safer than leaving it behind in Ardeen, regardless of how little power remained to it. "What about Raoul?" said Liza. "Did he show up again?" Kate barely nodded. He rematerialized afterward, and kept us from killing that fucker Jason. He reminded Ellendine and me that without Jason's help the Kray would have overrun us, and that would have been the beginning of the end of everything, not just Ardeen. I bet we could have taken him. With all his plans down the toilet, he was a mess. He would have been happy to let us do whatever. Liza snorted. I wish Raoul hadn't stopped you. Jason might have had second thoughts and threw in with the winning side. But let's not forget, he's the reason everything almost went to hell. Probably, but I can sort of see how it happened. When Desire and I were in the hall, Carter implied that Jason's anger wasn't entirely misplaced, and that Carter had done something bad to Jason. I'm not sure what, but Carter felt guilty about something that happened before. Might be why he wanted to do right by his old pal. Give him another chance. Stupid, said Lysa. Kate frowned. Probably, yeah.
So, did you say Raoul? Paldridge asked, or is he...
I couldn't get into the hall and reincarnate him, or resurrect him, or whatever.
Damn, said Paldridge, and awkwardly reached out to pat her shoulder, before letting his hand drop again.
Yeah, I'm still mad at him, though. He was a spy from some other world in the Strange this whole time, lurking here on Earth, masquerading as my friend.
He was your friend, Paldridge said. He pretended to be from Earth, but not how he felt about you. He obviously cared for you.
A crazy thought struck her. Had her inevitable fear of disappointment prevented Kate from pursuing a deeper relationship with Raoul? Had she just been afraid to take a risk? She'd wasted so much time being angry at Raoul, feeling like he'd betrayed her by keeping his origin secret, when regardless of what logic dictated, he was still her friend. In fact, she missed the hell out of him, despite how much he'd pissed her off by lying for all those years they'd known each other. That she was mad at him and missed him desperately at the same time, it was crazy. Maybe she wouldn't even be so angry if he didn't mean something to her.
Moisture welled in her eyes, and she scrubbed at them angrily. She and Raoul had never been more than friends, but that didn't mean she didn't love him, even though he was a fucking liar.
He's still there, in Ardeen, Kate said, as a ghost, waiting for me until the next time I go back, which I eventually need to do.
I owe him, too.
I don't want him to get sucked into Ardeen's underworld mythology. Something to do with the Night Vault and Umber Judges.
Sounds medieval, Lysa said. Keeping him safe from that? It sort of makes you a hero.
Kate discovered she couldn't speak anymore. They sat with their own thoughts for a time. Paldridge ordered another round. After they came, he said,
So, the other thing to remember is that we're safe. Carter saved us all, not just you or even just Ardeen.
It sounds like everyone on Earth owes him.
Yeah, said Kate. Grateful to have something else to think about.
Not sure about how we'd pay him back, though, since I'm pretty sure he's dead.
We should have a wake.
I know what we should do, said Lysa. We'd dedicate our new organization in his memory. The man gave his life defending the world from planetivores. It only makes sense that the sole group on Earth that knows about the Strange would honor the person who opened our eyes to the threat. So instead of just the estate, we call it the Carter Morrison Estate,
eh? Asked Paldridge.
Something like that, said Lysa. We should work out the details. Maybe some kind of Morrison endowment. But we could still call it the estate for short.
I like it, said Paldridge.
Me too, said Kate, raising her glass. To the estate.
And... To Carter Morrison, added Paldridge. They called him Carter Strange over there, Kate mused, in Ardeen.
To Carter Strange, said Lysa.
Kate clinked her glass against Lysa's and Paldridge's.
To Carter Strange. And hey, who knows? Maybe he'll be back.
He's come back from the dead before.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Myth of the Maker, a novel of the Strange, written by Bruce R. Cordell, narrated by James Carroll Jordan. Copyright by Monte Cook Games, LLC, 2017. Production copyright, 2018, by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.